Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Our conversation today will revisit the municipal bond market, as we will spend some time diving into the latest municipal market guide for the month of May. Title is A Sigh of Relief. Joining us for the conversation today, glad to welcome three contributors to the publication. We have joining us today from the Municipal Bond Research Team at the UBS Chief Investment Office, Janine Lennon, Ted Galgano, as well as Sudeep Mukherjee. So with that, Sudeep, I'll pass it over to you to start things off for us. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, Dan, and good morning, UBS. As Dan mentioned, the Municipal Market Guide titled A Sigh of Relief was published on the 14th May, the title reflecting the muni market's welcome relief that the tax exemption was left untouched in the House Ways and Means Committee's tax plan. There is a lot happening on the policy front, and we'll talk a little more about that later in the call. However, the sparing of the tax exemption will reduce the policy angst the market has been feeling, which in our view has played a role in the steep sell-off in April. Since that sell-off, as yields spiked and volatility spiked, munis have rallied, yields are lower, net fund inflows have strongly rebounded and turned positive. Supply is still elevated, but technicals, which is demand and supply balance, has improved and, in our view, will continue to improve as summer seasonal redemption demand picks up. Relative values in terms of muni treasury ratios moderated post-sell-off, but are still in the attractive range. Speaking of treasuries, the latest Moody's downgrade of the U.S. sovereign credit rating, in our view, has been making the headlines. In our view, while yields may move a little higher in the short term, it's unlikely to trigger significant selling. We do expect treasury yields to fall into the year end, but near-term volatility risks still remain elevated. All of that said, for investors, probably the most important thing is the tax equivalent yields on munis of around 6.8% and a steep curve are attractive and favor long maturities. But given continued prospects of treasury rate volatility and still elevated policy uncertainties, despite the fact that tax exemption is off the table, we still have a barbell preference in the 3 to 7 years and 70 to 30 years in the curve. We still prefer higher coupons in the 5 to 6%. A point to be noted there is higher coupons have fared a lot better than the 4s and 3s in the sell-offs. Fundamental credit quality remains very robust, you know, but although the ratings, the strong ratings upgrade momentum, which started post-pandemic, has moderated, which we did expect. Downside economic risks, though, are slightly lower after the progress that was made on the U.S.-China tariffs, but as all of that remains fairly uncertain, growth risks are still elevated in the second half of the year. In that backdrop, credit spreads are still tight, so we continue to prefer higher quality. Maybe a modest exposure of triple Bs in the front end of the curve is maybe appropriate for some investors with higher risk tolerance, but overall, our preference for higher credit quality remains. So in terms of positioning, a barbell maturity structure, higher quality and higher coupons would summarize our view. In terms of sectors, we do lean a little defensive given growth risks at the back half of the year. We like high quality state geos and utilities. So overall, I would say that the market remains very constructive and it's a good time to put new money to work in munis, especially given those tax equivalent yields. Now let's turn our attention to policy. A lot is happening on that front as the one big beautiful bill makes its way through Congress. Let me touch upon a couple of items and we'll talk more about that after that. Medicaid. Medicaid steep cuts have been proposed in the House Ways and Means Committee. But opinions within the Republican Party on Medicaid cuts remain far apart. Fiscal hawks actually want more cuts and more front-loaded cuts, while moderate Senate Republicans are against deep cuts. Overall, Medicaid cuts remain fairly unpopular, so this is a deeply political issue. But if steep cuts were to materialize, that would be credit negative for the healthcare for not-for-profit hospitals, especially the smaller rural hospitals that are more reliant on the program. A lot remains to be seen on that front, though, and nothing is final. A lot of things could change between now and over the next few months. The other aspect is the loss of clean energy tax credits under the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA. Both tax energy tax credits and transferability and what is called direct pay or elective pay, which allowed not-for-profit entities like public power entities, also called mini electric utilities, which allowed them to get credit for these tax breaks. They are gone and they are phased out. And so the cost of capital for these entities for carbon transition and investment in cleaner energy will go up. However, as I said, we like state geo and electric utilities, and on the latter, given attractive spreads, we still think the investment risk reward is favorable. Apart from that, there is certainly a lot of other policy topics that are in the bill and also outside the bill, SALT, AMT, higher education, sanctuary city funding, to name a few. And to talk about those, let me get my colleagues Ted Galgano and Janine Lennon into the conversation. Ted, can you give us a brief overview of some of these items that investors are reading about?
So as Sudeep did say, the Ways and Means Committee did release its draft tax proposal. And, you know, in case anybody else was wondering, like I was, why it's called the Ways and Means Committee. What are the ways we're going to pay for things? What are the means we're going to use to pay for things? And that's where the tax piece of this comes in, and that's what I'm going to focus on are a few of the taxes today. So under the proposal, the existing alternative minimum tax, or AMT, would be made permanent at the higher exemptions amounts and the higher phase-out thresholds. So just to be clear, you know, the AMT thresholds that are in place today will remain instead of expiring at the end of this year and reverting back to the 2017 levels. So basically, you know, this proposal is no change, right? So this would make AMT bonds more attractive to investors, or at least it should, as it ensures going forward fewer investors will be subject to the tax, since this would now be permanent as opposed to phase out again, let's say, in five more years. AMT bonds can definitely be an attractive way to pick up an additional 25 to 50 basis points in yield, depending on the credit, without increasing issuer credit risk. So that's an important piece of the pie there. So AMT bonds don't make up a big part of the market, and they actually are probably much easier to obtain in the primary market rather than in the secondary market. Secondly, the bill proposes to increase taxes on private colleges and university endowments. This has made a lot of headlines. The tax can rise from today's 1.4% to as high as 21% for certain institutions. So the tax would only apply to institutions that meet certain thresholds. This isn't going to impact all private universities. Matter of fact, it'll only impact a very small number of them. According to the IRS, only 58 institutions paid the tax back in 2023. So that 1.4% tax has been instituted since 2017. The most recent numbers we have is only 58 institutions actually met that tax. Now, that number will probably go up because they did make certain changes to how it's going to be calculated going forward. However, we don't think it will materially increase the number of institutions that are impacted. So the bottom line, you know, the tax will negatively impact colleges, okay? However, it will mostly impact how they choose to operate and to meet their particular mission. So, for instance, they may have to cut back on the amount of research they fund or how much student aid they provide. Those are the types of things that, you know, will most likely be curtailed. Critically, in our view, the endowment tax will not impair their ability to pay debt service on their debt. Okay, so we don't think, you know, this is a credit event for these institutions. For a list of schools that CIO covers that are impacted by the tax, please see a blog that I published yesterday titled Higher Education Endowment Tax, that is available on the Impact Portal. Now, finally, the last one I'll touch on, under the bill, the state and local tax deduction, or SALT cap. This one is probably the most contentious sticking point in the entire bill right now, and it remains subject to change in the House going forward, certainly still being negotiated. However, the current proposal would raise the existing $10,000 to the existing $10,000 cap would be raised to $15,000 for individuals and $30,000 for married couples, making up to $200,000 and $400,000 respectively. So the increase in the cap would be phased out. However, this is something new, would be phased out for those making over $200,000 and $400,000, depending on whether you're an individual or filing jointly married. Eventually, this would phase those folks back down to the existing $10,000 cap. So that, you know, that cap would remain available to everybody regardless of income level. So what's the impact on munis? In our view, the cap and the income threshold will most likely be raised going forward from here in order to get this bill across the finish line in the House. However, we do view this provision to munis as mostly neutral, because munis are mostly purchased by households above $400,000 income level. Therefore, we don't see this really materially impacting demand moving forward. So with that said, let me bring Janine into the conversation to discuss sanctuary cities. Good morning, Janine.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me on today to discuss sanctuary cities, which has frequently made headlines as it's been a focus area for the administration. First, let's start with what is a sanctuary jurisdiction or city. In its simplest form, it's a term that broadly applies to governmental entities such as cities, counties, or states, which limit the degree of cooperation with federal immigration agencies. While the Center for Immigration Studies lists 13 states and 225 localities as having sanctuary policies, the term sanctuary is not actually legally defined, sparking much confusion as matters reside within the courts. With immigration matters being top of mind for the Trump administration on the campaign trail, it was really no surprise that one of the first executive orders signed on January 20th was related to funding cuts to cities that do not comply with federal immigration policies. Soon after that order was signed, Attorney General Pamela Bondi issued a memo to cease the Department of Justice's federal funding to sanctuary cities. With that, lawsuits were almost immediately filed, and on April 24th, we saw a federal judge for the Northern District in California issue a temporary injunction blocking the administration from withholding DOJ funding to the 16 sanctuary cities and counties that filed the lawsuit. In response, President Trump signed several additional executive orders, which now requires the DOJ and the Department of Homeland Security to prepare lists of non-abiding sanctuaries. So yes, a lot of back and forth here between the federal government and cities across the nation making headlines. Importantly, we've been down this road before during Trump's first term in a series of back and forth that worked its way through the federal courts and the Ninth Circuit. But notably, the matter never ultimately was reviewed by the Supreme Court since the case was lifted by the Biden administration. Now, things may still take time and run their course in the courts, but this time feels a little bit different given the previous lessons learned and the speed in which things are being filed. Looking ahead, in the event the courts do decide that federal funding can be reduced or eliminated, those affected would see a misalignment between revenues and expenses and would need to either reduce programs offered to residents, draw down reserves, increase taxes and fees, or some combination of one or more of the items to offset funding cuts, all of which are tools intrinsic to munis to some degree. With states and local governments receiving a combined 20 to 40% of their revenue from the federal government, CIO will certainly continue to monitor the evolving situation and its impacts on the municipal market. With that, thanks for having me on today to discuss, and back over to you, Sudeep.
Thank you, Ted and Janine, for those great comments, great insights into what's happening on the policy front. So just to round it off, it was a big relief to the muni market as a tax exemption was left out of the reconciliation bill. Sometimes what is left out is more meaningful than what is in. So on that front, really, that's a welcome development. That said, policy uncertainties are elevated, as we've talked about various elements in the bill and outside that will play a role in the market going forward. All of that said, between policy uncertainty and treasury rate volatility, both of which are still concerns, and the economic potential slowdown in the back half of the year, all of that said, munis remain a very attractive asset class right now. The tax equivalent yields are high, the slope is steep, credit quality is resilient overall, and relative value is still fairly attractive, and we are heading into strong seasonal redemption demand. So there is not a lot not to like about munis from an investment risk-reward perspective right now. For more color, we urge our audience to read the latest edition of the Municipal Market Guide titled A Sigh of Relief, published on 14th May. And if there are any questions, Ted, Janine, and myself, Sudeep Mukherjee, we stand ready to answer your questions. Over to you, Dan.
Thank you, Sudeep. Again, a big thank you to Sudeep Mukherjee, Ted Galgano, as well as Janine Lennon from the Municipal Bond Research Team here at the UBS Chief Investment Office. Again, we have been making reference to the latest Municipal Market Guide. This is a monthly publication from the UBS Chief Investment Office. The title for May, A Sigh of Relief. For clients of UBS, please be sure to reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of this publication directly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.